You'll have to defer beyond me. So let me make sure Roger erased this for me.
I was having so much fun with that.
It looked like it. It did make me nervous, too. Yes, that's right. Andres and I had a long discussion about what we should title this. I wanted to call it Nothing's the Matter with Kansas, maybe The Road from El Dorado. Andres chose this one. It's exciting. Straightforward and functional, which is fine. Linda pointed out at the beginning that much of the research that NIJ funds, in fact, all of it, is a partnership between researchers and government, and this project in particular has been a strong partnership between ourselves and the folks in Kansas. Both Roger and his staff at the Department of Corrections, who've been patient with us and provided us with much data after repeated requests and changes to what we wanted. The Sentencing Commission has been great and helped us a lot with advice, with assistance in understanding what's going on in Kansas, with accessing data for us and helping us understand how to work with the data. And NIJ, with their continued support of this project and advice early on about the way to approach what we were doing there. I just want to say one thing about SB 123. It's unique and not unique in different ways. There have been a number of states in the last 10 years or so who've taken on an initiative of mandatory drug treatment in some way in the community in lieu of incarceration. California's Proposition 36 did it. Arizona's Prop 200 attempted the same thing in Kansas, both through voter initiatives, though. Kansas initiative is the first legislatively adopted statewide initiative to provide mandatory community-based drug treatment in lieu of incarceration. Other states have done it on a smaller scale through legislation. Texas has a small program for people who are state jail-based who would be directed to state jail in the state for low-level drug possession. Indiana has what they call a forensic diversion program, which attempted to do the same thing but was watered down soon after its passage. Kansas is unique, though, in a statewide effort to provide mandatory drug treatment in the community in lieu of incarceration for those convicted of low-level drug possession. Roger touched on several of the things that we're going to talk about. The goals of the program, as we see them, were twofold. One, to affect the state at a systemic level, right, to affect practices within the criminal justice system. Sentencing practices, right, to change the way people were being sentenced in the state for low-level drug possession, to have them sentenced to the community, community-based corrections rather than to prison. It was intended to affect supervision practices in the state, not just who was supervising drug possessors in the community, but how they were supervising drug possessors in the community. The point about understanding that relapse is part of treatment. Understanding that the focus on partnerships with drug treatment providers was important to the success of the program. And what we found in early conversations with folks in the community corrections districts who were responsible for supervising offenders was that these treatment partnerships were happening, that changes in focus or approaches to supervising drug offenders in the community was changing. And it was also intended to have an impact on treatment provision in this state. Increasing availability of treatment, the number of treatment providers in the community. So at the systemic level, it was intended to have an impact, reducing reliance on prison, changing practices in the community. And it was intended to have an individual level impact as well, to actually change recidivism rates, to change offender behavior, to change substance abuse patterns among offenders. What I'll talk about is the systemic level and how successful the state has been at actually changing practice in the state, and it's been very successful. Andres is going to talk about the individual level impact, where there's success, but not at the same scale it is at systemic level, and we'll talk a little bit at the end about how these two things go together and how it may, you know, how you may evaluate the overall success of the program in lieu of these two kind of separate goals that the program is intended to have. As Roger pointed out early on in his talk, right, the point of SB 123 was to change sentencing practices. People prior to implementation of SB 123, those convicted of, this is SB 123 eligible cases, these are offenders convicted of a first or second offense of simple drug possession. Andres and I had a long discussion about what was complicated drug possession. We couldn't come up with what it was. Nonetheless, simple drug possession, who have low-level criminal histories. Criminal history score in Kansas E through I, which means they have no prior person offenses. They're also ineligible if they have any prior drug sale or manufacture offenses. So when we talk about SB 123 eligible cases, we mean people convicted of simple drug possession of first or second offense who have no prior person offenses, drug or manufacturer or sale offenses. So prior to SB 123, most people were being sentenced to court services, which is, as Roger said, was standard probation in the community. It's minimal supervision, it's minimal conditions, it's for a relatively short period of time, about 12 months, and that's what most people were getting. Few people were getting community corrections, about 30% were going to that, which is somewhat more supervision, more conditions than court services, still supervision in the community, and about 10%, 8% were going to prison prior to implementation. And you can see afterwards, sentencing practices changed dramatically. Right now, most people are going to SB 123, about 70%, and it plateaued fairly quickly. And the rest is dispersed to court services, community corrections, and prison, which is, as Roger pointed out, the intent, right? These people would be shifted off of the court services caseload and onto the community corrections caseload. Now, initially, the impact on admissions directly to prison looks slight. It decreased from about 10% of all cases prior to implementation to about 4% afterwards. Later, we'll talk about how many people that actually turns into in over the first 5 years of the program. But sentencing practices changed quite quickly. If we just look at this, which puts it in a different context rather than over time, you can see the shift. One thing to consider is, there are two things. One is the burden placed on community corrections, right? Prior to implementation of this act, they supervised about 30% of drug possessors convicted in the state. They now supervise 88% of all drug possessors convicted in the state. As Roger pointed out, that was the intent. They were willing to take on the burden. Sorry about that. The middle one should be community corrections. Sorry, the light blue one is community corrections. I apologize. Andres was supposed to type the typos. I was the conceptual person. Andres was the detail man. Nonetheless, so for community corrections, it had a strong impact on agencies in the state, right? They're now burdened with 88% of drug possessors. Prior to implementation, they were burdened with about 30%. It has a profound impact on individuals as well, right? Prior to implementation of SB 123, 62% of drug possessors in the state received minimal supervision, minimal conditions while in the community, a short period of time, about 12 months that they were supervised. Now, 88% of drug possessors in the state receive much more supervision, a lot more conditions under community corrections, and spend about 4 more months under supervision in the community than they would have prior to implementation, about 16 months. That, when we talk about at the end, the impact of the program and individual outcomes matters a lot, right? When you talk about impacts on recidivism rates, the more you're supervised, the more conditions you're put under, the longer you're supervised, the more likely you are to fail through revocations primarily. And we see that later when Andre, I don't want to mean to steal your thunder, later at the end of the presentation. We'll also see how community corrections has responded over time, though, right? When this first happened, right after passage, and they brought on all of these drug offenders onto the caseloads of community corrections officers, they continued to supervise these offenders much the way they had supervised anyone else in the community, right? Monitoring, surveillance, enforcement in the same way they had in the past, rather than, as Roger pointed out, looking at this as a treatment population, looking at relapse as part of treatment, as part of the process of treatment. And it took time for that change to kick in among probation officers. And we can see that in their use of supervision interventions and treatment interventions over time. Excuse me. But you can see there's still 30% of what we deem eligible offenders not going to SB 123. And that's a question for us, is why is that, which we haven't determined entirely yet. So there's something happening in the state, whether it's about, circumvention by judges or something else going on. But we can see that it's across all different criminal history scores. Again, this is criminal history E through I, which means people have no prior person offenses that they've been convicted of. And you can see among this group that this particular group, criminal history score I, they either have no prior criminal history or they only have prior misdemeanor convictions. Of any of the groups on this chart, this is the group that should all be going to SB 123, but there's a sizable number that haven't over the life of the program. SB 123 is meant to be mandatory in two senses. One, on judges, in that they had to send eligible offenders to the program. There was some ability to depart from that for if they provided reasons that they could sentence someone to another sanction. It's also mandatory on offenders, that they can't opt out of the program. This is also what makes it different than things like Proposition 36. Prop 36, you can be sentenced to Prop 36 and then decide you don't want to go and take whatever other sentence you're given. In Kansas, that's not possible. You have to go to SB 123 and serve the sentence in the community with treatment. So we find some apparent circumvention here, but we also find it at the other end of the spectrum in that many offenders who aren't eligible for SB 123 are nonetheless getting sentenced to SB 123. These offenders with criminal history scores A through D are people who have prior person offenses in their histories and who would be ineligible for the program. Again, judges can depart and sentence someone to SB 123 who is otherwise ineligible. Nonetheless, there's some circumvention of the law going on among judges. So it's changed sentencing practices almost entirely the way they expected, but there's still these instances in which it's not happening. What we found when we were looking across the state is that these circumventions were rather concentrated in particular areas of the state. There was a divide between rural and urban counties in their departure from the mandatory nature of SB 123. There's also a difference between the rural and urban jurisdictions in their supervision practices of SB 123. So there's something going on in the state around implementation of these jurisdictions that we're still trying to understand. Excuse me. Thank you. So this shift in offenders from court services to community corrections for their supervision has also led to a pretty big change, as I said before, in the length of time they're actually supervised in the community. You can see SB 123 offenders spend about 16 and a half months in the community under supervision. SB 123 allows judges to sentence people up to 18 months of supervision and treatment in the community. There's no requirement that they sentence folks to up to 18 months, but that's generally the sentence that's imposed. But you can see it's significantly longer than what they were getting prior to implementation, about 4 months. And that 4 months matters a lot, given the conditions of supervision that they have under community corrections and how different they are from court services. And this is partially due to, the structure of SB 123 rather than any change in practices. So these have several implications. The number of offenders sentenced under SB 123 has grown steadily throughout this period. The system itself has seemed to adapt fairly well to that. Given the volume, the change in volume of offenders coming through, there's no real change or delay in processing, in assessments for offenders before they're sentenced to SB 123 or afterwards. The state has responded very well to that. Community corrections seems to have responded very well to that, to the increases in caseloads. There has been a reduction in the number of people going to prison under SB 123. While it may appear slight in percentage forms, in the absolute numbers that we'll see over a five-year period, it's actually quite large for a state the size of Kansas, and it has a profound impact on the costs of prison in the state. And overall, the system appears to be working the way it was intended. There are some issues and some challenges still, though. This determination of eligibility for SB 123 is still a question, whether everyone understands eligibility even after 5 years of implementation, whether everyone agrees with the eligibility criteria under SB 123 is another question, whether judges are going around the law for certain groups of offenders who either aren't deemed the right population for community-based supervision and treatment. And there's also these urban and rural differences in the practices in the state and this overall increase in sentence lengths, none of which may have been intended during at the time of implementation. So the second piece that we wanted to look at was whether supervision and treatment practices have changed as well. Sentencing practices clearly have. Supervision practices also have changed quite profoundly in this state. We looked at the types of interventions that community corrections officers were using, right? As Roger pointed out, there was supposed to be a change in their approach to the supervision of drug offenders in the state. We wanted to look and see how probation officers were using interventions that they could use, right? Employment programming, education programming, mental health programming, and reintegration programming. And you can see over time, there's a huge increase in the number of mental health interventions that community corrections officers are using. This may be a nature of dual diagnosis in the state, that many of the people who are drug offenders also have mental health issues that the community corrections officers are trying to address. But you can certainly see over time, after about 18 months of program implementation, the number of interventions goes up significantly and has continued to rise over the study period. The other interventions show less of a dramatic increase, except for in employment programs, where the community corrections officers have also started to use those a lot more. So we see a change a bit in the use of these supportive supervision practices. And we've seen a decrease in what we've decided to call restrictive supervision interventions. Right? Those things like curfew, increased surveillance, restrictions on movement, reporting practices, things like that. Particularly around issues of restrictions on movement and increased surveillance. Probation officers have started to use these a lot less over time. So we do see some change in their approach to supervising this particular population, at least in the use of their restrictive supervision interventions that they've been using. As far as treatment goes, we haven't seen a real change in treatment modalities imposed. For the most part, they've remained fairly stable, particularly those around outpatient, individual, or intensive treatments. There's some decrease in the use of outpatient group treatment and an increase in relapse treatment provision, which you would expect, right? Over time, you would expect the use of relapse provision modalities to increase. But generally, it's remained fairly stable. What has changed, and I said before, is this approach to treatment as a team approach. Probation officers and counselors alike told us that they see themselves as working as a team now, right? That they're both invested in both supervision and treatment and understanding the needs of offenders in the community and working together to make sure those needs are met. Probation officers and treatment counselors meet regularly to devise plans, to reform those plans over time to make sure that they're meeting all of the needs of offenders. Two things that we have noticed in this data around supervision practices and treatment practices that ultimately affect the overall impact of the program are the concentration of SB 123 sentences. These counties, 10 counties, account for more than 50% of all SB 123 cases in the state. There are 105 counties in the state, and more than half of all the SB 123 offenders come from just 10 counties. Which means the success of the program is heavily dependent on the supervision practices of these 10 counties. In a similar way, they're heavily dependent on a certain group of drug treatment providers. The dark line here represents, the dark blue line represents the total number of treatment interventions that have happened in this state. Right? You see they've gone up dramatically since implementation. The red line represents the percentage of those interventions that are provided by the top 15 treatment providers in the state. There are about 120 drug treatment providers in the state. Is that right? 140 drug treatment providers in the state, and just 15 of them account for more than half of all treatment provided in the state. So treatment is heavily concentrated in very few providers. The success of the program is heavily dependent on the success of these particular providers to provide treatment in this state. What this means for this state is that the availability of treatment is very limited by the market. As Roger pointed out, the program was to rely on existing private drug treatment providers in the community, right? Non-state drug treatment providers. So it's heavily dependent on the treatment that they provide, where they happen to provide it, the number who happen to be providing it. So what's been happening is we found to a large extent through our discussions with probation officers was that treatment decisions were often made based on availability, access to providers rather than needs, right? And this concentration in a few providers has created this particular approach to treatment. But SB 123 also hasn't created incentives for more people to enter the market. The number of treatment providers in the state has not grown over the last 5 years, as was initially expected, right? As Roger said, they pay more for treatment under SB 123 than they did for other than other treatment paid for by the state. But that increase in the amount paid for treatment did not translate into an increase in the market. And what you find in the state then, as Roger pointed out, in very rural parts of the state, there's one drug treatment provider. And if they're bad, it doesn't matter. That's where the people have to go. That's the only treatment provider. Or you may find that the only person who provides residential treatment is hundreds of miles away from the person who needs residential treatment. So they either don't get residential treatment because it's too burdensome to send them there, or they're sent far away from their community and family to get residential treatment. So what happens is people have changed their approach to treatment, right? That you may not get what you need. You may get what's available right now. And what this is, the next question, this is where I'll end, is the impact on the prison system, right? As Roger pointed out at the beginning, this bill was passed at a time when the prison population was reaching capacity, was going to go over capacity. This bill was intended to reduce the number of drug possessors going to prison as a way to prevent the prison capacity from going, or prison population from going over capacity. So the question is, what impact has it had on the prison system? In the first 5 years of the program, SB 123 averted approximately 463 sentences to prison for drug possessors. Of course, that's only part of it, right? This is directly from court. So that reduction from about 10% to 4% in the number of people going to prison has translated into about 463 people being averted from prison. That's only half the question of its actual impact on the prison system, right? Because as Andres is going to talk about, it's also about revocations to prison. And the shift in people from court services to community corrections has changed revocation rates, right? The revocation rates for this population have gone up. And the next question is, how much has that affected the impact on the prison system? And I'll leave it for that for Andres to talk about this individual level impact of the program that we've also been looking at.